my special guests today are Professor Erwin Lowe, who is Chief Medical Officer here at Monash Health in Melbourne, and Jessica Dean, who's a recent graduate from Monash Uni and a soon-to-be intern here at Monash Health, and a former president of the Australian Medical Students Association. Thank you both of you for your time. Well. Jess, you two are co-authors on a four-debate piece that's going in our 18th of January issue on pharmaceutical sponsorship of medical events, mm-hmm. education, and why we should be getting out of that and trying to transition into other forms of sponsorship. Why is this an issue, Professor?
It's a huge, complex topic. Pharmaceutical companies clearly is an industry that's required to develop new treatments to help practitioners like ourselves provide new technologies and medications to our patients. So they are, and they do a good job at it. You know, it's a very expensive thing, and you do need a lot of R&D in this area. Having said that, clearly clinicians like us, and this applies to any clinician, not just doctors, need to have the ability to have autonomy, to be able to make their own clinical judgment and decisions in relation to which modality of treatment is right for the patient. To the extent, there needs to be an environment that is free of potential bias, undue influence, and this extends to potential unnecessary advertising and potential sponsorships that might raise questions of conflict of interest. And this is also important from the point of view of the public, because the public needs to be assured that the profession is free of any potential control by third parties, whether it may be pharmaceutical companies or whether it might be government or any other lobby group. And so the community needs to be confident that medical practitioners and other clinicians are able to practice health and provide them with treatment that is independent, that is free from bias, free from conflicts of interest, and if there is any connections to industry, that has to be transparent so that they receive the best care that's evidence-based for them and their families.
Doctors seem to be pretty consistent in thinking that sponsorships or gifts from pharmaceutical companies don't influence their prescribing. Jessica, I mean, they're kidding themselves, right?
Well, this is what's really interesting, is that it's been a pretty significant cultural change within the profession over the last 10 to 20 years. And I think with that comes, you know, a really slow, I guess, social change as well, which is that doctors pride themselves on being able to identify where influence exists and navigate that complex situation. But I think what we're seeing in the evidence of late is that there's a bit of a disconnect between what doctors think they're able to do in avoiding bias and influence and what is kind of the actual experience. And that's, I guess, the most pronounced with the really what would be perceived as small influences.
Yep.
So the dropping of a name here, or, you know, the presence of a company logo or branding, or even really small gifts such as pens, where I think some of the older doctors who might remember the days of the full paid conferences see that kind of as paling in comparison, when really what we know from the data is that that still results in positive attitudes towards those companies, and as a consequence, impacted prescribing behaviour, resulting in more increased prescribing and less quality prescribing.
We're in an environment these days where research money is hard to come by.
Mm-hmm.
I think the latest success figures for NHMRC grant is something like 13%. Doesn't that mean it's inevitable that we have to get corporate entities involved?
But it's not an inevitability in the sense that it is reality at the moment. So, you know, most clinical trials are sponsored trials, right?
Yes.
The majority are. And in fact, in investigative initiative trials are in the minority. And that's because, again, as I mentioned before, to get a drug from benchtop to actual bedside requires billions of dollars and decades of actual trialing, you know, through the different phases. So I think that requires a lot of money and a lot of effort and a lot of coordination. And the drug companies do them very well. And the point is not about where the money comes from. It's more the structure that's put in place to ensure that there's transparency, there are governance processes in place, there's human research ethics reviews, there are rules which exist, you know, the NHMRC are very, very good clinical practice and as a whole and ethics framework mm-hmm. that governs human research that works quite well, actually. There's a whole research governance framework that exists in Australia. It's one of the best in the world and also quite efficient. So there are there's no question that clinical, in particular pharmaceuticals and device trials, require a lot of money and require sponsorship from industry. And the point is, there's nothing wrong with that as long as there is clear separation between where the money's coming from, who's providing the money, and the independence of the researchers, you know, the lead, the principal investigators. So that's important. I mean, the point about the sponsorship, there's a whole spectrum, right? You've got trial sponsorship, which is actually required. There is a system that works, and it is a system that benefits both the community, the patients, as well as the industry, because industry also needs to have a return of investment, and as long as there's independence. And then that goes all the way down to, you know, providing sponsorship for conferences and educational programs, down to just giving free gifts. There's a whole spectrum. And the first thing to point out is that clinicians, in particular doctors, but you know, really this applies to any practitioner, are intelligent people, right? They make their own decisions. No clinician I've met have consciously decided, oh, I've got some gift, I'm gonna prescribe that drug. No, I've not met anybody who does that consciously. Now, the issue that Jessica's raised is the unconscious advertising that occurs, that, you know, the name of the drug becomes more familiar to the practitioner, and therefore when it comes to prescribing, they might think of that medication more. Mm. Now, so, and research actually shows that probably does happen. So I think we all have to be careful about that. That's one huge section of it. The other side of the coin is really the public perception. You know, even if that doesn't happen, the public needs to have confidence that there is independence in the way medicine is practiced by the practitioners. And if there is lots of sponsorship, if the community, the public thinks that there is influence and that people are being paid to prescribe in a particular way, then that degrades the whole reputation of the profession of any of the practitioner groups, and that's bad for everybody. So I think we need to maintain that independence as well.
Are there ways of weaning ourselves off pharma sponsorships and onto other kinds of sponsorship? Jess, maybe you could talk about what PAMSA did.
So, I mean, that's a really exciting prospect that we're seeing internationally gaining momentum. Mm-hmm. I think maybe 5-10 years ago, it was a really kind of scary thought that we'd move all of, you know, what is quite a large volume of funding away from pharma, and that we'd be able to find other means to support those events, conferences, or even just areas of funding. Yeah. Whereas what we're seeing is that AMSA did it almost a decade ago. They started the conversation with quite a rigorous process of research and, you know, a 30-page guideline document that was implemented over a series over, I think, 2 years. And then the consequent policies that have been enacted to more rigorously implement that. We know that it's possible. The American Medical Students Association has done the same. Yep. They have an even more rigorous conflict of interest policy and procedure. And they've also managed to achieve that redistribution of reliance, funding reliance, which isn't easy and does take time, but is definitely possible. There is the potential for a funding cut. Pharma does tend to pay quite well. Yes. And so these are all things that need to be taken into account through that process. But it's definitely possible. I think it's really a question of what our priorities are and how important it is to us as a profession, as an industry, and as, you know, like Erwin was saying, when we consider the public perception.
You're a brand new doctor.
Yes.
What's
very fresh.
Very fresh. You're new to the profession. You just come out of uni. What are students thinking about this, and what are they being taught about it?
Yeah, see, that's what's really interesting, is that students are coming from a place where we have a really solid understanding of the potential influence on prescribing behaviours that can occur from exposure. Yeah. And so for us, it's quite strange. A lot of universities implement quite strict policies to try and protect students.
Yeah.
So in the university environment, there's no pharmaceutical penetration at all. We know that in most of the hospitals, the students specifically are very well protected from pharmaceutical influence. And so to come into the hospital environment and be treated like, you know, another member of the profession and seeing, you know, sponsored lunches and things like that is quite strange, to be perfectly honest. But to understand and appreciate it, that it comes from a really long, elaborate and complex history of relationship between the medical profession and the industry, it makes it easy to understand. But I think maybe that's why there is such a strong push from AMSA and the student organisations for this kind of last step to kind of eradicate the residual presence that's unnecessary. Mm-hmm. So as Professor was saying earlier about it being a spectrum of influence, at the far end where really the purpose of the presence is one of influencing prescribing behaviour, it's very difficult to justify. Yeah. So sponsored lunches, pens, small gifts, those sorts of things, even presence at like sponsorship booths and stalls and expos.
CPD.
Yeah.
Events, yeah.
Yeah, even that kind of extent where we know that the only reason, I mean, there is an argument for education in that context, but it's a smaller one, that the main reason that the pharmaceutical presence is there is one of, you know, influence and trying to influence prescribing. And that's where it becomes much more difficult to justify. Whereas at the other end of the spectrum, where the primary pursuit is education, it's much, I think, easier to understand why a mutually beneficial but regulated relationship would still be beneficial to all parties involved. Yeah.
The reality is that pharmaceutical companies exist, right? And they have to exist because no one else is going to do this. Universities can't do it. Governments can't do it. There has to be an industry that helps us to actually discover new treatments. And they do that very well. They do it very effective. To the point about pens and things, everyone does it. Every other industry does it as well. So it's not as if we can just talk about pharma and they're special. They're like a private company like any other private company.
Yeah.
They have to do what they do to advertise and to be known in the world and to sort of promote their product. I mean, that's what they do.
Yeah,
and the key is to ensure that there are boundaries around that promotion and that it is done within the context that is appropriate. Mm. So we have good rules. I mean, they can't advertise directly to patients, you know, and as society evolves, this whole framework changes to keep up. See, you know, things are very different now. In fact, the industry itself, I think, has done a lot of good work. Medicines Australia, which is set up by the industry, has set up a self-governing process that seems to be working. It is evolving as well.
Yeah.
So gone are the days of the free vacation or, you know, things like that no longer exist, and that's the right thing. And now, I think in the hospital setting, the key is to ensure that we, as you say, that we replace any potential perception. And to me, it's the main point of all this replacement of potential pharmaceutical and industry presence in especially in a public hospital setting is to maintain the confidence in the public. They provide the tax money that funds what we do here in a public hospital at Monash Health, and that we need to be able to be good custodians of the public money. To ensure that it is used in the right manner, to ensure that what we provide is best evidence-based care for the good of the community and the public. And to that end, you know, as you correctly point out, the key is to replace and to find alternative sources of funding of the things that we do, like tutorial programs and things. So, and we have done that. So, you know, we no longer get any pharmaceutical sponsorship of any of our junior doctor education programs, for example. We've gone to alternative sources like medical indemnity companies, financial companies that are interested in advertising to doctors. That's what we've done, because that has got nothing to do with the clinical practice.
I actually think that one of the more difficult challenges will be where the benefit that we're seeing realised at the moment can't really be justified. So where there's, say, a sponsored lunch that, you know, in 5 years' time might just be a meeting without a lunch, they're kind of the, I mean, it seems really obvious, but, you know, I think they're going to be some of the difficult cultural obstacles to overcome, where we're really used to being, you know, granted these little kind of niceties. You know, it's a long day and, you know, a farmer rep might visit you in your private practice or in the hospital setting and, you know, all of a sudden there's this really lovely lunch that everyone gets to eat. Something like that, which might seem really obvious, is really difficult culturally to overcome because, you know, it's, I mean, Professor, you're the best person to answer this, but a lot of those things may not be appropriate for the hospitals to replace them. It's not just farmers evil and we need to move away from them. As we've already said, there's heaps of really important beneficial elements of the relationship that need to be supported and nurtured, that improve and have great potential to positively impact the doctor-patient relationship and the just treatment and practice of medicine. I think what's important is identifying and clarifying what the nature of the relationship is, what its primary purpose is, and identifying any potential negative consequences of the relationship. That there are heaps of opportunities for positive interaction, but where the primary purpose is to influence prescribing and nothing else, then I think it's where we need to be particularly judicial with our exposure and just look for other more appropriate means.
Sounds like a good place to stop. Thank you. Thank you both for your time today.
Thanks.
You.